All right, ladies and gentlemen, call the meeting to order and welcome you all. Welcome you all to the regular meeting of the Board of Directors of the Metropolitan Transit System. And I'll ask the clerk to please call the roll.
Alvarez. Mendoza.
Here.
Bragg. Cole.
Here.
Mullen.
Here.
Gomez.
Here.
Mathis. McClellan.
Here.
McWhirter.
Here.
Minto. Rios.
Here.
Roberts.
Here.
Salas.
Here.
Sankey.
Here.
Zaff.
Thank you. I turned off my mic because you're getting a little feedback there. So no further comments. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Thank you. Well, we'll take item number four, which is to elect the vice chair, chair pro tem, and committee appointments. Sharon Cooney will introduce the item.
Yes. Per our board policy, you all appointed an ad hoc nominating committee. For a slate of committee appointments, as well as to make a recommendation on the vice chair and the chair pro tem. The order of business will be that we'll vote on the vice chair and chair pro tem first, and I'll leave it to the chair to do that.
Yes, as you know, the recommendations for the vice chair is Supervisor Roberts, the Chair Pro Tem, Mayor Salas, and the committee appointments, which should be on that list in front of you. So I'll take a motion to approve that with the understanding that those members who are on the slate will not be voting for themselves. Thank you. So it's moved by Ms. Zapp and seconded by Ms. Cole, Council President Cole. All in favor, please say aye. Aye. Opposed? Thank you very much. I'm going to take public comments, and as soon as we finish public comments, I will then have a special order of business for you. So first speaker under public comments is Gretchen Newsom. Ms. Newsom, will you please take the voting? You have 3 minutes, and you'll be followed by, in the order in which they're received, Kristen Victor. If you'll be ready to speak when the first speaker is finished, and then we just have the two speakers. Go ahead, ma'am.
Thank you. Gretchen Newsom on behalf of IBEW Local 569 and our 3,300 electrical workers and power professionals in San Diego and Imperial Counties. I'm joined today also by Joel Basor and Lynn Miner, also of our staff, who are also California State Certified Electricians. Last month, I came before you to alert you to electrical hazards and public safety concerns that our staff, both Lynn and Joel, had uncovered related to the installation of new MTS solar bus shelters. With written documentation, we entailed the dangers posed to the public by the sloppy installation of solar bus shelters by your public-private partners, Clear Channel, and their subcontractor, ND Electric. And IBEW 569 requested a follow-up meeting with our staff, who were, again, California State Certified Electricians, for a full debriefing. Instead of meeting with us so that we could fully detail all the risks posed to the public health and safety, your MTS Director of Marketing sent us a response letter stating that your partner and subcontractor admitted to poor craftsmanship, which in our opinion could have led to serious injuries to members of our community. Additionally, the MTS response letter essentially said, worry not, this will be taken care of by Clear Channel Inspections, your private partner, an entity that you had trusted to properly make these installations in the first place. To ensure public safety, accountability, and transparency, and that the inspections are happening and that rules and regulations are being followed, we ask that these inspection reports and documentation be shared with our office as vested members of the public and community, in addition to the information that we requested as a follow-up letter from our LMCC on January 13th of this year, which I can share with the board at a later time. I believe it's already been shared with you, though. I want to reiterate from last month that this is not a union versus non-union issue. This is a matter of public health and public safety. Again, we want the public protected and for this electrical work to be done by trained professionals that are California State certified electricians. Thank you.
We can refer this.
Thank you very much. Go ahead, Ms. Kuhn.
We'll go ahead and have a meeting with the group over this issue.
Okay, next speaker.
Good morning, board members. I'm Kristen Victor, and I'm here on behalf of the community group Beautiful PB. We're the eco district within the Pacific Beach community that's the model community in the City of San Diego Climate Action Plan. I am the co-founder of Beautiful PB. I'm also a resident of Pacific Beach, and recently my husband and I moved our businesses to Pacific Beach after being in Little Italy for 21 years. I am working very closely with the City of San Diego, MTS, Sandag on the last mile of the Midcoast trolley, getting people to off the trolley into our community safely. But today I'm here on behalf of Beautiful PB, the Discover PB, the community of Pacific Beach to once again ask about the farmers market. So about 5 months ago, we came with a petition that had been presented to MTS to shift the farmers market onto Garnett Avenue. Since then, on Garnett Avenue, another pedestrian has been killed. Did any of you guys know that? Aware of that? Okay. So does anybody know that Garnett Avenue is one of the most dangerous streets in San Diego? It's top 10 in Vision Zero from Circulate San Diego. So our community has come together. We had all the businesses sign this petition that was presented to you, to MTS, in support of shifting the farmers market. There are no bus stops within the three blocks that we're requesting. It's one afternoon a week from 2 to 7 p.m. And two blocks away is Grand Avenue, which is a major thoroughfare, which the buses should be going up and down only, in my opinion. So I'm here today to ask you why you have not supported our community in shifting the bus service off of Garnett Avenue one afternoon a week. And I ask that you very seriously consider this, because once again, another pedestrian has been killed. We have new businesses moving into this area. We have a kids' gym. We have a sock store. We have a new restaurant. The climate is changing within our community because of the efforts of us. And we need you to support our efforts. It's not okay. We are the people of San Diego. This is our community. And we're simply asking to shift bus service, one bus that makes no stops in these three blocks, from our community two blocks away. We have the support of our council member, Lori Zapp, who's written a letter to you and to the city. And I really do not understand why you're not supporting our efforts. So I think each one of you needs to like dig deep and figure this out and support us, support the community, and support the people of San Diego for safer communities.
All right, thank you. Your good time is up. Appreciate your coming down here. We understand we've had some conversations on this, and we'll be talking to Ms. Zapp about it. Okay, that's our final public speaker, and I'm going to take a privilege here, which I'm sure you'll appreciate, and have a special order of business I'd like to conduct, and I'd like to ask our MTS bus operator, Robert Dempsey, to join me at the podium.
Well, every now and then, we have an opportunity to honor.
Is that better?
Every now and then, we have an opportunity to honor someone who's done something really extraordinary. And in this case, Robert Dempsey had an occasion to react to, and he reacted in a very selfless and courageous way. And I'd like to give you some of the details, and I have a special plaque that I'd like to present him on behalf of the board and the management of MTS. On Monday, December 5th, at 1:30 in the afternoon, Robert was driving a relief car southbound on State Route 163 in the vicinity of the Washington Street exit when a nearby driver lost control of his car and actually flipped the car, and it rolled over several times, narrowly missing hitting the car that Robert was driving. The car ended up on its side. Robert immediately stopped the car. It jumped out and went over to try and get the driver out of the car. They successfully extracted the driver, and as they were pulling him away from the car, it burst into flames. So for this selfless act and something that gives us and our organization a great deal of pride to recognize Robert's selfless and courageous action, which undoubtedly saved the life of the driver. So it's my pleasure to present him this Distinguished Service Award, presented to employees who perform deeds of exceptional merit. Robert M. Dempsey, with great pride that MTS recognizes your extraordinary action on December 5th, 2016, to protect the life of another.
Thank you very much.
Mark, let's get Bill on.
Thank you very much. I appreciate this. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, real quick.
Yeah, you did.
One, two, three. Get one more. One, two, three. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for honoring him. I read about that, and he absolutely saved the life of that person. So it was great to see him, and thank you for honoring his heroic efforts. Really cool.
All right, we'll move on to the consent items, items 6 through 16. And is there anyone who wishes to pull any of these items for discussion or comment? Seeing none, I'll take a motion then to approve.
Move to approve.
Excuse me. Okay, McMurder moved. You seconded by Ms. Rios. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, thank you very much. All right. Before we go into a closed session under item number 24, I have a speaker, and I'm pleased to welcome Mr. Michael Aguirre here, who would like to speak on this item before we go into closed session. Mr. Aguirre.
Good morning, one and all. The Public Transit Employee Association is very happy that we were able to come together and to have an agreement that had not been negotiated. And I see my dear brother, Ron, good to see you. We're growing old together, and I'm glad to see we are both still alive, and Harry as well. So, yes. I want to talk to you about the charger thing later, okay, but we'll come back to that. But I want you to know that the way that we got here was through the intervention of a wonderful mediator, June Papayo, who is a conciliation service mediator from, he was from Fresno, and he came down and we had two long sessions and preceded by a great deal. And I just wanted to pass this on to you. The reason I urged the leadership to take on this agreement, because it didn't get them anywhere what they really wanted, but it got them some things, was because we wanted to send a message to you that we really do want to work with management to build the very best that we can. But what I have to pass on to you is this. In working with the employees and working with their leadership, it became very clear to me that we have a very, very harsh working environment. And you know, our COO told me that, you know, in a way, because of safety, you kind of have to have it be a little bit military, and that's probably true to some degree. But there's also things that are just seem to be unnecessary hassles. These people are working super hard. So I just tell you that our goal in the future is going to never take advantage financially. We will not make any claims for anything that creates a financial problem, because that's not what public servants should be doing. They should be serving the public. But we are going to be asking to lighten up a little bit. And we'll be having discussions, more discussions. But there's issues about people working more than 8 hours a day, not getting paid overtime, people working as full-timers but being treated part-time so they don't get their vacation and their health care benefits at the full-time level. And then this business with auxiliary supervisors going back and forth, not knowing what they are for 4 and 5 years at a time. So those are all issues that we have on the table that we want to work with. But we're very happy, very excited, and really appreciate the fact that you allowed the mediator to be there, and we look forward to next year and having even a better agreement and building towards an ever better system. So thank you very much, and again, we're very excited about this getting approved, and hopefully urge you to do so.
Thank you, Mike, and I appreciate showing your experience by stopping right at the 3-minute mark. Before we go into closed session, I would like to make note of some new faces here, and I'd like to welcome Georgette Gomez, who is a new council member with the City of San Diego. Welcome, Georgette, to the board.
Thank you. May I take some time to just greet everybody and introduce myself a bit? Yeah, I'll take very little time. So I'm very, very happy to be with all of you today. I was the recent elected council member for the City of San Diego in District 9, which is the mid-city area, City Heights, Kensington, College area, all the way south to South Crest. I've been working quite a bit in trying to improve our transit system. So one of the things that I, as coming into City Council, one of the areas that I really want to continue pushing for is improving our transit system. So I'm very happy that I was able to get the assignment to be part of MTS board. I'm looking forward and working with every single one of you and really trying to do our best in having a world-class public transit system and infrastructure that's needed, and I'm looking forward and working on those issues. And thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you. Welcome. Okay, and I also want to make note of that we have representing I should say standing in for, let's see here, I gotta look at my thing and remind myself. Lori Bragg, yes, and I understand Lori has had a death in the family. Her mom died, and so she's not able here, and we certainly send her her condolences. She's not here. Lemon Grove, yeah, thank you. Anyway, we welcome Jennifer, and who is standing in for Lemon Grove. Okay, we'll go on then into closed session.
Chair, before we do that, I'd like to welcome everybody that's new to the board. But also I would like to introduce my alternate who's in the audience today, and that's Mike Diaz. He's recently elected to the City Council. Mike, would you please stand and let everybody know who my alternate is?
Oh, good. Thank you for that. And, of course, John Mullen is here standing in for Jim Cunningham from Poway. Okay. We'll go into closed session then. Hopefully we won't be going long. We're back in open session, and our council will report out.
On item number 24A, closed session conference with labor negotiators on three separate bargaining group tentative agreements, including the PTEA representing SDTI train operators, electromechanic service persons, and clerical staff, and the IBEW Local 465 representing SDTC mechanics and servicers, and the IBEW Local 465 representing SDTI flaggers. The board voted to ratify three separate tentative agreements, one with each of those agencies, on a vote of 12 in favor and three absent. The absent members were Councilman Alvarez, Councilwoman Bragg, and Minto. All others were in favor.
All right, we have no notice of public hearing, so we'll move on to items 30 and 31, and Larry Marinisi will make the introductions and start off.
Yes, good morning. Thank you, Chairman Mathis and members of the board. Once again, we welcome RVK and Chiron to discuss the San Diego Transit Pension Plan from an investment results perspective, as well as the actuarial results. And so item 30 is the investment status for the San Diego Transit Pension Plan as of June 30, 2016. And I welcome Jeremy Miller here to do that presentation.
Thank you, Larry, and hello, everyone. We have on the screen here, we have on the screen here the presentation, so I'll walk through some of these slides. Just by way of introduction, 2016, as I'm sure you saw just watching the news, was a difficult year for a number of different economies globally that impacted asset markets. It was a difficult year for asset markets globally, which of course made it difficult for investment portfolios, including the San Diego Transit portfolio. For what it's worth, this was a difficult year for others as well. Your peer plans, local and state, much larger and open plans, also had similar returns, struggled in the 0 to 1% range. Your calendar year-to-date returns have improved, as we'll see all of this as we go through the presentation, about 7.5% calendar year-to-date, and long-run returns over 9% historically. So you've done well historically. It's been a difficult year, and we'll walk through some of the numbers here. On the first slide, you can see the investment structure as of 6/30/2016. You can see on the left, as you walk down the table, the various asset classes you're invested in, as well as the market values and the allocations as a percentage. And the goal here is to maximize return while taking a prudent level of risk. So we try to keep this well diversified, but also acknowledge the fact that assets are exist to satisfy liabilities. You have a closed plan. And so we want to create, given this liability structure, an asset structure that's quite diversified and quite liquid to satisfy your nearer term needs that the liabilities require. On the next slide, we go through a little bit more details, listing the various products and managers and strategies that you're in. So you have assets allocated across 12 different products. We believe this diversification helps to reduce the portfolio risk, and also keeping allocation sizes that small across active managers. The one large allocation is a passive manager, so just tracking the benchmark, the index, the market. The others that are active, we try and keep those allocations low to reduce your concentration risk in any one particular active strategy. On the next slide, we see the fiscal year performance 2016. And you can see that the plan returned roughly zero, so negative 0.09% for the fiscal year 2016. So again, not good news. Your actuarial rate of return is 7%, so well below that. Again, tough year for markets. You are not alone. And again, your calendar year to date and historical numbers, of course, are much better and above those actuarial numbers. So we're disappointed, but we think you're positioned well going forward with this portfolio. On the next slide, we have additional performance details. As of 6/30, and you can see again those the total portfolio at the top, and you can see it broken out across various asset classes. We think having this diversified approach with international strategies, real return and absolute strategies allow you to have a diversified portfolio, but also a liquid portfolio, that can be dynamic, take advantage of market opportunities and dislocations, and will position you well going forward. And on the next slide, you can see that fiscal year to date, 2017, has already started off well with a 2.33% return for the first quarter. Q4 is not completely in yet, all the data, but estimates are that it was roughly flat, so this return would hold for the first two quarters thus far in fiscal year 2017. So long story short, it was a difficult year. It's gotten a little better in 2017, and we think you're positioned well going forward. With that, I would conclude my remarks and see if there's any questions that the board may have.
I can understand it's a difficult year. The only thing in the whole report that that is somewhat troubling is that the fact that the plan underperformed peer plans. And is there a rationale for that? It would, in other words, I understand the market is what it is.
Yes.
But I would at least like to think that we're performing at or equal the level of similar plans.
Sure. So as I mentioned, some of the peer plans also struggled. So if we look at state and local, the ones that we typically look at as potential peer plans, the best performer was 1.4%, so better, but not much better. That's also an open plan. It's also a plan that is more than 1,000 times larger than this plan. And so given that the size and the open nature of the plan, those plans are able to hold illiquid asset classes that we don't think are appropriate for a closed plan because we have near-term cash needs, and so we don't want to lock up money for 10 plus years. And then in addition, obviously the buying power of a plan that's 1,000 times larger, that allows them to do things that perhaps we can't access. So some of those things have helped. That said, we're still in the ballpark despite the difficult year, and that again, that was one of the better returns for 2016. So I think going forward, things are looking good. So I think despite the difficult year, things are looking better.
And I would echo those comments. We made a decision once the plan was closed to become much more conservative with our investment approach. We certainly don't want to tie up dollars into some private investments, tie up liquidity. We want the value of the assets to remain there for the members and for the retirement pension plan.
Mr. Roberts.
Yeah, Jeremy, help me. I'm on, well, there's no page number, but the performance details. And there's two categories that look like they've been very, very poor performers over quite a while now, over five-year periods.
Performance details, right. So what we had here is the top line is your total portfolio.
Yeah, I'm looking down at the bottom line, a real return composite at 1.22 over since inception, and it goes back at least 5 years.
Correct. So real return assets, what we're trying to have is your fixed income assets generally do well when you have disinflation or deflation, when you've got bonds do well when there's not much inflation. We want to have something to offset that. Real return are things like real estate, commodities, et cetera, that will have do well during inflationary periods. The last 5 years or so have been pretty difficult for inflation. Inflation keeps coming down. But part of the reason returns have turned around in fiscal year 2017 is inflation has started to come back. And those assets that had not done well the last few years, last two, 3 years, have actually been some of our best performers thus far in fiscal year 2017. So we still think that despite it not performing particularly well the last couple of years, we think going forward as inflation increases, those real return assets will actually be a strong performer for the portfolio.
So in this last fiscal year, then you're saying that was a strong performer?
The fiscal year 2017 is looking much better. Last year was still, folks were worried about deflation. And okay. So things like commodities, think oil went down quite a bit fiscal year 2017. Oil has started to come back. Inflation has started to come back globally. And so fiscal year 2017, we're seeing much better returns. Your real return assets are some of your top performers.
Okay, so you're expecting, in spite of the fact that this hasn't, these two, both these categories haven't done well, that there's going to be an inflationary situation that's going to cause them to appreciate?
Correct.
Okay. I guess I'm wondering, since for the last 5 years we weren't expecting an inflationary period, why we had stocks that were looking at an inflationary positive outcome.
Right. So we wanted to have some assets that balance. So real return, part of that allocation is real estate. So we want to have some real estate just as in diversification terms. Even if you don't have a strong outlook for inflation, having some other assets to balance unexpected changes in market conditions can be a good diversification tool. So having some real estate assets can be helpful, and also bonds, again, tend to do really well during those deflationary periods, which your bond portfolio did. And so having something to balance that if there's an unexpected change in market conditions can be helpful. So sometimes you have parts of the portfolio that zig when the others zag, and fortunately some of those balance out. So yes, real return did not do well the last 2-3 years.
Okay, I guess I'm laboring the point, but it seems to me over the last several years there was not an expectation that we were going to have an inflationary adjustment. And yet we stuck with this because there's something called balance.
Markets are anticipatory. So we're not, when you hold something in your portfolio, it's not that we need to wait until inflation has already started happening. It's that if markets expect it to start happening, you need to hold it before the event actually occurs. And so we want to have positions in the portfolio that are able to take advantage of that. So that's why we had that in anticipation of markets changing in the future.
Okay. It just concerns me when there's like over a third of our investment in these categories that are just not giving us anything. It seems like maybe a little less balance might be in order.
Mr. Sankey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Following up a little bit on Chairman, on Supervisor Roberts' remarks, the allocations seem like a standard portfolio in terms of international and domestic and that sort of thing. You're talking about the 1 year, and you're telling us it's good news that there'll be inflation, that oil prices will go up. That's troubling to other parts of our business model, frankly, and that's troublesome to hear. But on the other side of it, I'm kind of looking for a little bit of background. You're looking at 5 year and long-term performance data. How long have you, how long has your company been involved in managing these assets? And how often, this might be a broader question for the organization, how often do we look at that particular relationship?
So we've had the relationship with RVK since I think the 97 or 98 period of time. We did go through a negotiated procurement in 2015. It was a bidding process. There were four participants as part of that negotiation, and RVK was the most received the highest technical scores, as well as the most favorable cost to the agency. It was a five-year deal with 5 one-year options, this being the second year of that contract.
And you mentioned cost. I noticed the outflows were north of $5 million over the course of the year. What percentage of that is money going to beneficiaries, and what percentage of that is cost to run the program?
Well, what that is a net outflow of cash from the plan. So we pay about $17 million in pension benefits in total, of which about $12 million or so is MTS's contribution to the plan. So the plan needs to make up for the balance of those, and that's what the $5 million represents, is the difference between the pension benefits that were paid versus the MTS contributions. Then that balance goes out from the pension plan trust.
Okay, I'll just ask the question more directly then. Of the $150 million that we have in allocation on an annual basis, how much does RVK make for their fee, plus or minus?
It's about $95,000.
Okay, thank you.
Anything else on this? Okay, that's an information item, Larry. Let's move on to 31.
Yep, number 31, we have Ann Harper and Alice Alsberg. here to talk to the actuarial report now that we have the investment returns. That obviously moves into how what the outlook is from an actuarial valuation perspective of the plan. And this is as of June 30th, 2016 as well.
Good morning, we appreciate you having us here. We're here to talk about the actual valuation as of July 1st, 2016. So we're going to briefly recap the recent experience study we did, which is an analysis of all the actuarial assumptions, look at the contribution level for 2016, look a little bit into the past to view the plan's history, and then look forward to see what the plan looks like in the future. So back in April, we did an extensive study where we looked at all the actuarial assumptions. We looked at both the demographic and the economic assumptions. And the demographic assumptions are things like when people are retiring, how long people are living, and then the economic assumptions are things like inflation and the investment return. And we look at these assumptions to see if they're aligning with the plan experience, and where there's deviations, we recommend changes. So the Budget Development Committee approved our recommended changes, and there really were, to most of the assumptions, just small tweaks, with the exception of two of those assumptions. One being how long people are living, and two being what your assets will be earning. And the plan experience and recent studies have shown that people are living longer, and that trend is predicted to continue into the future as well. So mortality improvements into the future. So we did update our mortality assumption, and what this did to the cost of the plan is it increased it, because if people are living longer, you pay more benefits from the plan, and you pay because you're paying them for a longer period of time. So this increased the cost to the plan. We also reduced the investment return rate from 7.5% to 7% based on the current and future market environment. And we did this, we coordinated with Jeremy and his capital market assumptions and how the assets are allocated. But also in setting the assumption, we also looked at other investment consultants as well, and overall, investment consultants in general are predicting lower returns, especially in the next 5 to 10 years. So these trends, the longevity and investment return trends, are not unique to MTS. You're seeing them throughout all plans in California that are making these kind of adjustments to their assumptions for mortality and investment return. Specifically, too, just recently, CalPERS reduced their investment return rate from 7.5% to 7% within the last month. So I want to walk you through the contribution change from last year to this year. Last year, the contribution was $12 million, and due to our the impact of the experience study, increased that by about $2.7 million to $14.7 million. Now, that contribution level is based on the 2015 data that we use and also the investment information. So when we update our calculations for the current 2016 data and the June 30th investment levels, the contribution rate increased slightly to $15.1 million. And that's primarily due to the investment returns over the last few years, which increased the contribution about $800,000. And the effect of the closed plan, which is that fewer actives are earning benefits in the DB plan, because now they're earning, they're getting contributions in the DC plan. So those fewer actives earning benefits here is about $274,000 of a decrease. And also those benefits that these active members are earning were projected to be slightly less since salaries were less than expected, about $238,000 of a decrease there. this pie chart shows the components of the contribution, of the $15.1 million contribution. The red slice of the pie is about a quarter of the pie, and that's the cost of benefits accruing for the active members. So that's $3.8 million. 75% of that pie is that UAL payment of the debt at $11 million. Those are due to actuarial gains and losses from the plan, which are primarily asset losses at this point, and it also considers assumption changes or any plan changes that are going to affect past benefits, which is not happening in your plan, but that that can increase the UAL. And so what we, the funding policy that you currently have in place is to pay that debt off, that $11 million debt off, by 2037. And at that point in time, you'll just have the payment of the cost of accruing benefits, all assumptions being met as the caveat.
All right, next I'll take you through the next few slides that show the plan history. This first slide shows us contributions made to the plan over the past 10 years. We see that in 2016, as Ann covered, the contribution is at $15.1 million. Now, what stands out in this bar of the graph is the blue shaded area, and that area is showing that the contribution, if you look at the gray portion of the 2016 bar, it's similar, it's in line with expectation in 2015, but given the assumption changes, the improved mortality and the reduced discount rate, that contribution does increase by that $2.8 million. And in this time frame here that we're looking at, the 10-year period, the plan has steadily taken action to take risk off the table. In 2007, the contribution rate was lower, but we were also measuring liabilities based on an 8% discount rate. Now bring us to 2016, that 8% discount rate has gone down to 7%, and so we see an increase in the contribution given the increase in assumed liabilities.
You're also seeing the increase in the contribution from 2008 to 2012 is primarily due to that, the poor market returns in 2008, and you've seen that it being phased in over a five-year period there.
Now, here we take a look at the plan's funding, so the funded ratio. Just to clear what's going on this graph here, the gray bars represent the liabilities of the plan, and the lines are the assets. We have the gold line, which is the market value of assets, and the blue line, the actuarial value of assets. Now, what we do with an actuarial value of assets is we provide some level of smoothing so that it brings on somewhat of a less volatility to your contributions. The 2008, we see that from 2008 to 2009, there was a big drop, as we all know, with the market crash. And so the market value of assets, the yellow line, dipped down 2009, 2010, whereas the actuarial value of assets held steady over that period of time as we were phasing in the losses from that period. And the idea there is to maintain a little more stability in the contributions going into the plan. So in 2016, we see the gray bar, the liabilities of the plan, that's right about $290 million, whereas the actuarial value of assets is at $168 million. So the gap between the line and the liabilities represents, it shows visually the UAL, the unfunded portion of the plan. And the ratios at the top of the bars show the funded ratio, so the actuarial value of assets to the liabilities. And in 2016, we see that the funded ratio is at 58.2%, which is a drop from 2015, the 65.7%, and that was largely driven by the assumption changes. Now, in this last graph showing plan history, we take a look at active membership, and we feel that this graph is important to visualize, to understand the dynamic of what's happening with the members who are in this plan. As Ann mentioned, and we know that the defined benefit plan for SD Transit is largely closed to new members, 2011-2012. It closed to union members. There are certain non-contracts that it's still open to. So we see in 2012 to 2013, there was a dip in active membership. And it's because new actives who are coming in are going into the DC plan rather than the DB plan. So we're going to steadily see a decline here in active membership, where we see in 2016 we have 552 active members still in the plan. Now, another important statistic is the average age of the members in the plan. In 2016, the average age is 51.63. By seeing that increasing average age, what that's showing us is that we have a shorter time horizon to when the liabilities come due, when benefit payments start getting paid out. And with that shorter time horizon, it's important for us under a closed plan, knowing that these liabilities are coming due, to work with RVK to make the assets, make sure that the assets meet the needs of the liabilities of the payments.
These pie charts are really a continuation of what Alice just presented on the active membership, but it shows the whole plan dynamics as a whole, in total. And it's comparing the demographics and the liabilities in 2007 on the left-hand side of the slide to 2016 headcounts and liabilities. And it shows how the plan is maturing. So in 2007, there were the ratio of retirees to actives was about 1-to-1. And then by 2016, that ratio has increased to about 2 retirees for every active. And you're seeing this dramatic shift because the plan is closed. So there's no influx of new active members in that yellow pie slice. In the above chart. In 2016, if you look at the plan liabilities, you can see that about 2/3 of the liability is for the retirees. And as Alice was saying, that means there's the shortening investment horizon. So your plan investments, or your plan is much more sensitive to investment returns because of that. And your obligations are due sooner, because you've got that shortened investment horizon, so there is this real need to have more liquidity in your plan to be able to meet your obligations when they come due. So that it is important to continue, like Alice said, to monitor where your investments, how they're invested versus what your liabilities look like and when obligations come due, so there's a match there. So we looked at where we were today, and then we did a little look at your plan history. So I think most importantly, what people want to know is what's going to happen going forward. And so there are some projections that we're going to show you, but I'd like to make a couple caveats before that these projections are only estimates, and they're based on the plan meeting every actual assumption in every single year. So that would be the plan's going to earn 7% every single year going forward, and people are going to retire and die exactly how we're assuming. And so to continue with that thought, it's the actual experience that's actually going to determine what future contributions look like and what the future funded status of the plan looks like as well. This slide shows the total contributions to the pension plan from employers and employees from 2016 to 2037. Currently, the contribution is 15.1. It's expected to increase slightly over the next 5 years to 16.1 as those asset losses are being slowly phased in over time. And then at that point, you're going to see the contribution come down over the next 15 years as the unfunded is paid off, and there's fewer actives earning benefits in the plan. Once that debt is paid off in 2037, the contribution will fall to about or is expected to fall to about $1.1 million. This is the projection of the funded ratio, the ratio of assets to liabilities. We're at 58% right now on an actuarial value, and we're anticipating that to, you know, stay steady over the next 4 or 5 years and slowly increase over time. I want to point out that the liability level stays stable by 2025, and then it starts to decrease as there are fewer members in the plan. And then the assets are steadily increasing, so the plan is expected to be fully funded in 2037. So today's takeaway are that you have some assumption changes that are affecting your plan costs, but they're very, very consistent with the industry trends going on in California. Year over year, the cost rose slightly, primarily due to market returns. And in the future, you're going to see the cost increase slowly over the next 4 or 5 years to $16.1 million. But by 2037, we're expected to have that debt paid off, and it will drop to about $1.1 million. The last note is that blue slice of the pie that I showed you, those retirees, that's going to continue to grow, while the yellow slice, the actives, will continue to shrink. So it's very important to continue to monitor how your investments align with those liabilities. So that's what we have today. Is there any questions that you have for us or anything you want to revisit?
Anyone? Mr. Mullen.
I'll apologize, because this is kind of a generic pension funding plan that I just get a chance to ask you guys as opposed to anybody else running a pension plan. And that is, what am I missing in that if you look at our performance over the last 5 years, we're showing 3.69% return, yet we still project a 7. Is there a factor, an element there that I'm missing in what appears to me to be kind of a disjoint? Disconnect between what the reality and what we're projecting.
Well, over the course of the last 10 years, I believe we've moved that rate from 8% to 7% over the course of, again, the last 10 years, the last being within the last April of 2016, the board did approve the reduction of 50 basis points from 7.5 to 7. We're going to continue to look at that number. And really how the markets unfold over the course of the next few years. And we could be coming back to the Budget Development Committee and the board to look for additional potential decreases to that rate over the course of time. The markets over the last 5 years have not been good. And we're the anticipation going forward is that they will improve, but will they improve to the level of 7%? I don't know if anyone at this table could validate that or expect that.
Yeah, historical returns versus future returns. Obviously, sometimes when you have a difficult period, that means that going forward it might get better as valuations improve. I would just encourage all of us to consider recent returns in the broader, longer-term cycle, in that markets have their ups, have their downs. So as you look at long run periods, your historical return has been over 9%. And so we're at a period here where the last couple of years have been difficult for asset markets. And so the more recent numbers look difficult, but I think over longer periods of time, getting closer to that 7% is possible as we see valuations and other components of the market improve.
Anyone else? Yes, Mr. Sankey.
Thank you very much. Short of the fact that our plan is getting less and less people in it, which is probably troubling for the family members, but for us, good news. Is there any good news in here for us that I'm missing?
I think the takeaway is, it's a closed plan. There are fewer people in the plan. I think the biggest takeaway is because of the decisions that the board made to close the plan, that we can essentially pay off that debt over the next 20 years. That's going to be paid off, and then you're going to see a significant $10 million reduction in pension contributions in that 21st year. From an investment perspective, we're hoping that markets rebound. We've seen the first quarter of this fiscal year has improved. We're hoping that that trend continues. But we also, again, have to remember that we want those assets to remain in the plan to pay off these pension benefits. And so we've taken a more conservative approach. We don't want to get to a 2008 or 2009 where we've seen equity markets go down by double digits. So we've taken some of the risk out. We want to keep the assets there for the pension benefits. And, you know, we feel that we're positioned from a, an allocation perspective in a good position going forward.
Okay, any more on this? Okay, the recommendation, of course, is, do we have a slide on that so that the members can see it? Otherwise, you turn to item 31 and see that the recommendation of the Board of Directors to receive the STCC Employee Retirement Plan, which is known as the Plan Actuarial Valuation, as of July 1st, 2016, and adopt the pension contribution amount of $15,087,407 for the fiscal year 2018. And do you want to add anything to that, Larry? Okay. So with that as a recommendation, this was taken up by the executive committee, and they forwarded it with a recommendation to approve for your information. So, Mr. McClellan, are you moving approval? I'll take a second by Ms. Rios. Any further questions? If not, all in favor, please say aye. Aye. Opposed? Thank you. All right, we'll move on then to item 32. You may recall in the wake of the failure of Measure A, we were wondering, you know, where do we go from here? And that being the case, I'm going to turn it over to Karen Landers to discuss in response, I think, to a request from Mr. Alvarez to take a look at this from the standpoint of being able to go forward with the sales tax ballot measure of our own, and she is going to cover that for you.
Yes, good morning. So as Chairman Mathis said at our December board meeting, Councilman Alvarez had asked that I research what MTS's ability would be to pursue its own sales tax measure, potentially just structured around our jurisdiction. And so I went and did that research and just wanted to report back to the board as where that leaves us. So taxes, especially are set forth under the California Constitution. And under that Constitution, when it gets down to local taxes, it says that only local governments may impose a tax for municipal purposes. But it retains for the state the authorization to let us do that. So basically what it says is that the state must first authorize local governments to pursue such taxes. So that requires us to look at where, if we have any express statutory authority that we can take advantage of to recommend a tax. Then, as most of you know, two-thirds voter approval is required to impose a sales tax. So looking at MTS's enabling legislation, which is in the Public Utilities Code, there is no express authorization to impose a sales tax in our legislation. What it does do is it structures that MTS will provide input to SANDAG regarding the Regional Transportation Infrastructure Plan, which we call the RTIP, and the Regional Transportation Plan, which we call the RTP. And then MTS is entitled to get funding from SANDAG for transit purposes that are consistent with the RTIP and the RTP. And that's consistent with, this predates our consolidation that happened in 2003-2004 timeframe, but what did happen at that point is that the state legislature restructured how we do transit planning and projects in San Diego. It used to be that both MTS and NCTD had our own independent planning and construction arms, and we would do all those projects ourselves. And instead, what SB 1703 did is it put all of those regional planning and regional construction projects under SANDAG's umbrella. And so this follows along with that. So then looking at SANDAG's enabling legislation, it does have the express authority to pursue a sales tax to fund transportation purposes that are tied to the RTIP and the RTP. So, you know, under their legislation, it says that the tax must be consistent with the RTIP and the RTP. It sets a max tax rate of 1% and then incrementally what you can ask for. I think it's in quarters. You know, they could ask for a 0.25% tax, a half, a 0.75%, or a 1%. The way that it's set up right now, it would have to be a countywide tax measure under SANDAG's legislation. And then SANDAG is required to allocate those sales tax revenues to both MTS and NCTD for transit purposes that are consistent with the RTIP and the RTP. So basically what that leads to is that current state law does not authorize an MTS-only sales tax measure. In order to do something like that, it would require a statutory amendment. Just in the preliminary research that I did, you know, the amendment could either be to MTS's statute or to a SANDAG statute. You could seek an amendment that authorized MTS to directly pursue a sales tax measure to fund MTS projects and operations, or you could seek an amendment to SANDAG statute that would authorize SANDAG to pursue a more narrow sales tax measure, so non-countywide, within the existing framework. There's certainly lots of questions and policy implications that for any option. You'd have to go through a tree and plan out. I know that in general, a non-countywide measure does create issues with the Board of Equalization, that is the agency that has to actually collect the tax. Those are normally structured along city jurisdictional boundaries or county jurisdictional boundaries, and I think that there is concern that it would not be possible with MTS, where we have certain unincorporated areas of the county that part of our jurisdiction, but we're splitting the county in half. And so how would you collect a tax in that way in the unincorporated areas? So there's lots of issues that would have to be thought through for any proposed action, which I'm telling you just to lead you to what our current staff recommendation on this issue would be, that we coordinate our additional research with SANDAG. It's my understanding that SANDAG is also looking at this issue, looking at, I think it's scheduled for the SANDAG retreat in February to review the results of Measure A and also discuss kind of path forwards at that point. So I think that any of these measures would really need to be coordinated because they would impact the structures and funding and measures and construction projects that both SANDAG and MTS are involved in. So at this point, I would recommend that we, again, coordinate that research and report back to the board for further direction as a policy or legislative proposal is developed. And I don't recommend one right now, but if we get into seriously looking at a proposal or wanting to coordinate one, it might be appropriate for the board to create an ad hoc board subcommittee to work more closely with staff on, you know, refining those, you know, legislative and policy proposals.
Yourselves.
Yes, thank you, Chair. So I was looking at this, and I actually had a meeting with Gary Gallegos and our chair of SANDAG, Ron Roberts, related to this. And I do still have some questions because you could actually take two tracks. If we're authorizing SANDAG to produce, pursue the narrow sales tax measure, that would be somewhat more problematic than it would be to authorize MTS to pursue a tax measure relative to its own jurisdictional boundaries, but both of them would require enabling legislation to do that, if I understand the staff report correctly.
That's correct. Either track. So right now there is no current statutory ability for an MTS-only tax. So we could either have it take the lead and fall under the existing SANDAG authority and how they do it, but it would have to then go through the SANDAG board and ordinance approval process, or we would ask the legislature to create a whole new ability for MTS to do that.
And really what you would have to look at when you were doing that is the public's appetite for a transit-only measure, because I know that we had to work really hard to get all these different cities and jurisdictions to sign on to you know, the Measure A sales tax measure, because some communities are open to more open to public transit than others. I know that the South Bay communities are very open to the public transit part of it, and really really advocates of public transit. Whereas within the jurisdictional areas, I also asked Mr. Gallegos to break out how the vote went relative to the Measure A results. And so I think that what we would have to understand is, if we're working within a jurisdictional area, we're going to have to include the areas of Santee, Poway, other areas that were not so supportive of public transit as the South County was. So I think that all of that has to be viewed in the equation of whether or not, if we went through the process of the enabling legislation, if ultimately we could prevail on a sales tax measure. That's another question that we have to really wrestle with. But yet I really believe that looking at MTS's ability to tax is something that we should pursue on an ad hoc level, at least, so that we could, you know, get some members of this board that would be interested in that to really work on that and understand more fully what that would mean. And so that I'm putting that out there.
And we can certainly look into, on the February board meeting, putting that together. You know, and I certainly just wanted to advise that they are very complicated proposals that you would put forward, and it could morph from allowing, you know, what do we ask for? Do we ask for an MTS only, that you have to ask for MTS's full jurisdiction, or do you ask for MTS's ability to propose a sales tax only in certain portions of their jurisdiction that might be supportive of it? And those are all things that would need to be developed, and I think coordinate with SANDAG, because SANDAG has a lot of the data from Measure A that will really inform us on.
Yeah, and I thought that we couldn't break out the MTS jurisdiction into areas. So if there's a possibility to do that, then that would be an interesting thing to examine.
And so my research at this point was just limited to, can we request an MTS-only sales tax? And so, you know, certainly if the legislature approved us, you know, they can structure what we're allowed to ask for.
Okay.
I would, this is a purely policy decision. So this is something that it's important to have the board weigh in on. And that's why Karen's giving you the facts here, and it's your opportunity now to direct us based on those and your own personal opinions.
You know, it's instructional to kind of look at the LA experience and the ease with which they've been able to pass bond measures that finance public transportation, and they do it because I guess MTA has that authority, and as a result, they're sponsored by MTA, so that in a purely jurisdictional environment, they're able to do it in LA, and they've been able to do it very successfully. They've passed several bond measures. They're up over a cent and a half now, and is still going strong, and anyone who's been through LA recently, you can see that there's a great deal of construction going on to extend light rail along the freeways, and they passed very readily because there's been a unity basically of support from all the different elements, people who are in a sense looking at public transit as something to ease the traffic situation on the freeways. Here, the way we're organized, it's unbalanced, as has been pointed out. There's much, you know, public transit is really concentrated in the city of San Diego and south, and of course east. But you get up into North County, and you're asking them to approve a pure measure for public transit when they don't benefit materially from public transit. And so we have this dichotomy going in San Diego that is different from the areas in LA that are so strongly supportive. Politically, it's much easier to get something through on public transit, as it turns out in LA, than it is here, because the jurisdictions, that is the various jurisdictions, cities and towns that make up the LA region, don't get involved in trying to make sure that somehow there's some benefit to them personally, and they're asked to vote on it. They don't decide on it, and so that is an endemic problem, and that's what we're up against if we try and go it alone, as MCDB used to be able to do. Mr. Roberts.
Go ahead.
Yes, Ms. Gomez, go ahead. I'm sorry.
What would it take to explore the legislative requirements that would need to do to be able to do this?
I mean, it's just there's certainly legal research that would need to go into it, but then it's just crafting what we would potentially want to ask for, you know, and then every time you come up with a proposal of what would we ask for, then you have to think in advance of, well, what are all the ramifications of that? How would you collect the tax in that area? How would you pursue that so that if we go forward with a legislative proposal, I would like us to not have unintended consequences or have it not work for us. And so we need to refine what we want to ask for and then make sure we fully vet what we're asking for. And if we need other legislative changes that would make that possible, we then include that in the package. So it's not, it's just a matter of time and working and refining what the proposal was. And the only reason why I said right at this moment, coordinate with SANDAG, is I know that SANDAG's doing that same analysis, so.
Just to follow up, as we're, I mean, we on the agenda, we're talking about the legislative agenda that we wanna set. This could be a part of exploration in terms of in the future. It just seems like a lot of the efforts take a lot of time, and starting now for possible future might be a good thing to do in terms of our abilities to do something as a jurisdiction.
Yeah, let me maybe just help a little, because we're doing a lot of analysis on what was right and what was wrong. It's not clear to me that if MTS had the authority to do a tax over the MTS territory, that that would be successful either. And these are the things we need to figure out. I mean, I could craft the district that I think would be very successful, but I'd have to cut some cities and some other things into pieces, and that's not allowed by the Board of Equalization, the way you're able to actually get the taxes and distribute them, whether that would. And I think, you know, if you created like a pro public transit area and a pro public roads area, they'd both be, you know, the two of them would not add up to the whole county for sure. And it would raise issues if you were collecting money for MTS within a specific city and you're trying to run a system to cities that aren't in that, you know. So I think we've got some work to do before we ask the legislature to do something. And that's kind of what we're working through, and MTS and SANDAG are working together on this. I think hopefully we'll have some better answers as we work through, and especially look at some of the outcomes and even some of the historic outcomes. A two-thirds vote is very, very difficult, I'd say that. You know, extremely difficult, and you really need to have everybody on base. When you have segments, as we had, of the population that insist it's got to be my way or no way, it's very difficult, you know, and in this case, the opposition from both political parties, we did something nobody's been able to do nationally. We unified the two political parties. But the sum of the opposition, if you look at where the positive votes came from, it sort of flies in the face of where some of the heavy opposition was. And you're right, Marisela, you know, at Chula Vista and National City and South Bay generally, mm-hmm. you know, we knew they were very pro-public transit, and they didn't seem to listen much to the anti-messages. But in the North County, they weren't, perhaps because of some of the mailings that were done in opposition, in the North County. That's kind of where we're lost. In the East County, I'd say that. So we've got some, you know, we've got some work to do, and I hope, you know, I'd like to see us, by the time the next ballots roll around, that we're in a position to have something teed up. But it's going to take a lot of work, and I wish I had the exact answer, but I think we're understanding the questions better now. And, you know, some of us put an awful lot of work into this, mm-hmm. and I know you did, and I am very appreciative. And there are some others that were in very responsible positions that chose to say, no, it's either got to be all my way or no way.
I'd like to get some opinions on whether you think it's a good idea to have an ad hoc committee set up to focus for this purpose, or just to leave it basically in the hands of the EC. Mr. Rios.
Thank you. Although I believe we should continue to work with Sandag and moving forward, because it seems like this does require a lot of work that is not going to happen quickly. It's unfortunate that Councilmember Alvarez is not here, since he, you know, proposed this. So I'd like to see that we also hand in hand coordinate an ad hoc committee that could also look on one end of this in regards to what MTS could do as we work with Sandag. And I'd like to make that in a form of a motion.
And I would second that. Yeah. Okay. Go ahead.
I'll be happy to second that.
Thank you. Are there any other comments? I think there's a agreement here, and it's certainly a consensus to support. I know that's where the EC is to make sure that we're not trying to go this alone, but they're working closely with Sandag so that we can basically do it the right way, which I think is doing it.
Could I make a comment that our February board meeting is the week after the Sandag retreat? If you would like, what we could do is table that suggestion and have that conversation at the Sandag board retreat to kind of say, how can MTS work with Sandag on this? And then we could come back to the board in February to provide a report.
Yeah, the Sandag retreat is going to have a pretty in-depth analysis as one of the items on the agenda there. And I was thinking, you know, if there's several people on this board who aren't participating in that, it might be good to maybe have that similar report given to this board prior to or as part of our next meeting regarding this. I think it'd be helpful for all of you to see, you know, what really happened and better understand the playing field and the sort of the dilemma that it poses for us.
Okay, if, of course, that's something you can set up.
So then what you're suggesting then is, before we make a decision on whether or not we form an ad hoc committee here, we wait and see what happens at the Sandag retreat. That doesn't preclude us from forming an ad hoc committee.
I'm not against an ad hoc committee. I think we'd benefit from having a lot more detail mm-hmm. than we have in this report here today, and then decide what's the appropriate thing.
Can we arrange then to have that report that's given at the retreat to also be given at the meeting that will take place the week after the retreat?
Yeah.
Then we'll put that on the agenda. Yes, Mr.
And I would be in support of that, as long as we here at MTS board are given some type of report, because not everyone here, especially some of the new council members, are have access to attend. I mean, not access, because everyone can attend, but they're not in a position where they're getting that information directly. And so I think if everyone could get the information about the Sandag board, even if they have to you know, pay for that out of their own pocket, at least they're aware that they could attend that and exactly where that would be on the schedule, so if they wish to participate as well.
Yeah, the individual presentations, anybody can, you'd have to pay anything. I mean, you can attend. The payment is you're going to spend the the time there so that the rooms and the meals and all that.
Okay.
But anybody can go to any of the presentations.
So if we could get that out to every council or every board member in MTS, because I know there was a period of time as an alternate, I didn't receive that information. So I just want to make sure that all of that information gets out to every member here so they have the ability to be present if they choose to.
Okay, as soon as we get the agenda and the times that this particular discussion is scheduled, we'll get that out to the board members so that if you want to be there for that discussion, you can be. It's going to be out at Barona, and it's going to be the 8th to the 10th, I believe.
Yep. What I'm recommending, though, is that maybe we can have a similar presentation here so you don't have to, for those of you who aren't going to be there, you don't have to drive out to Barona. We'll make it a little more convenient for you.
Provide both of those opportunities. I think that would be great. Thank you.
Well, we'll certainly put that on the agenda for the week following the discussion at Barona. But if anybody is interested in going out there, certainly that information is available. It's going to be at Barona, and it'll be the 8th to the 10th of February. I think that's correct, isn't it?
So does the maker of the motion want to kind of hold back on that motion in a second?
I will hold back on the motion that we look at the ad hoc after we've had the report from the retreat. Thank you. And also that it comes to the board here. Thank you.
Is that okay with the second, Ms. Hollis? Okay. Okay, that's the motion. All in favor, please say aye. Aye. Opposed? I'm sorry, Ms. Gomez, did you want to? No, you're fine. Okay. All right. It passes. Thank you.
Okay.
Okay, I'm going to take item 46 next. We'll get that in, and then we'll go to 45. So we'll talk about this stormwater briefing, and Ms. Landers will do that.
And this allows me to stay at the desk. So I'm going to give you a briefing on our MTS stormwater program. I'd also like to introduce Mylene Noseda, who is our environmental analyst back here. She works on all the nitty-gritty details of our stormwater compliance and other environmental issues at MTS. So to the extent anybody has specific questions, I'll likely defer them to you. We just wanted to give the board an update about where MTS's stormwater compliance program is and the processes that we're going through right now. And there are some budget impacts that we're going to be seeing because of this. Many of you may already know that stormwater regulation in California, for us in San Diego, is overseen by the San Diego Regional Water Quality Control Board. And there is what's called an overall general MS4 phase two permit, which most of your cities already should be members of. MTS has not been an MS4 phase two permittee. We are kind of the last group of agencies to be pulled into this. And so far, our stormwater program has consisted of having construction general permits when we're doing a construction project over 1 acre, having an industrial general permit at some of our maintenance facilities, and then having a no exposure certification at certain facilities that qualify for. And so right now we are in the process of becoming a MS4 phase two permittee. And what this will do is it's going to cover all of MTS's property, not just limited to those construction sites or those industrial facilities. So we'll be looking at our entire railroad right-of-way, our MTS-owned transit stations, and then it will loop in what we're already doing at those industrial facilities. So for us right now, we're in the Water Board enrollment phase. They gave notice to MTS in fiscal year 16 of their intent to enroll us, and we have been working with the Water Board since then to make sure that we're able and ready to comply at the time of enrollment. We were at first concerned that they would enroll us and we would immediately have all sorts of obligations and not have a structure in place to comply with those. And so they have actually worked with us cooperatively as we've kept them informed of what we're doing to get ready. We hired outside counsel to represent us in this process, and then we also hired an environmental consultant that the board approved that contract with Carson Sprinkerhoff's back in June to prepare a plan for us. And we're currently scheduled for enrollment at the Water Board's February 2017 meeting. What this will structure is that they're going to set our compliance schedule to start on July 1st, 2017. That was another request that we had to them, that we'd really like to be on a fiscal year plan instead of a random month to month, you know, in each year, that really helps us for budgeting purposes and other planning. And they were willing to go along with that. And we will, once we're enrolled, have 5 years to get our program developed and fully implemented. So as I said, we hired Parsons Brinkerhoft in June of 2016, and they are working on the 10 different elements that go into our stormwater compliance plan, some of which things happen in years zero and years one, and some of them don't happen until year five. But they are working diligently through that. The other permits that we have, I just wanted to kind of give you an overview of the industrial general permit that applies to those existing maintenance facilities that have outdoor activities that could then result in stormwater impacts. So for us, that's our Imperial Avenue Division bus maintenance facility, our Kearney Mesa Division bus maintenance facility, our trolley yard here, and then Copley Park Place, which is where First Transit has our minibus, you know, fixed route and our access facility. We have a no exposure certification, which basically means that there's been a determination that all of our stormwater type activities are indoors, and so that they're not a big risk. And that is the case right now at our South Bay bus maintenance facility and our East County bus maintenance facility. So we do currently and have been doing ongoing compliance under these IGPs. In general, what that means is we have to do regular sampling for various, you know, what the water board considers as contaminants, but basically that's sediment, metals, nitrates, and oil and grease. You test the water after rain events to determine what the concentration of that is. And then there's general maintenance that has to be done to make sure that these types of materials aren't making their way into the storm drains. If sampling does find a higher level of contaminants in the water, then that triggers the obligation to do various remediation projects and also triggers increased testing requirements. Just to give you an example of some of these remediation type projects that have been triggered by our stormwater compliance that we're doing right now, there is a vault that is in the ground that helps filter this out at our Imperial Avenue division. It's a little bit unclear as to when it was installed. So, you know, we've gone through this process as we're preparing our plan and discovered that it was not on any regular maintenance schedules. So while it was installed way back when, it had then was full of all sorts of sediments. And so we had to do a kind of overhaul to clean that out so that it could work properly. It has now been added to our regular maintenance, you know, schedule. And that's one of the things that this Parsons Brinkerhoff plan that they're working on, they're going through all of our properties and identifying any sort of, you know, facilities that we have like this and making sure that they're on our maintenance schedule and that they're being used as intended so that that type of thing, you know, won't happen again where, you know, a project was designed to, you know, take this into mind, but then, you know, the staff that does the regular maintenance didn't know that it was there. Another example is filters. This seems to be the most common remediation project that are applying to our properties where you have a storm drain that's on the property and, you know, you don't want to get all of those leaves or other, you know, sediment into it. And so we're installing filters over those two. Prevent them from making their way. We recently are in the process of installing one at the KMD facility, and then we are installing 23 different filters in drains across the trolley yard, and those are costly. So those are the types of things as we find and identify them, they're small, you know, capital projects that we have to implement. So now we get to the costs that we just wanted you all to be aware of. And also it will come into some of the budget process because they weren't previously budgeted for. So our overall phase two in the industrial general permit anticipated costs over this kind of 6 year period, which I'm calling this fiscal year and then starting next fiscal year, is about $2.3 million. $1.3 million of that is related to the Parsons Brinkerhoff MS4 phase two contract. So we've kind of scheduled some of their implementation development of the plan that really have been occurring right now and will then occur over the first year of our Permit phase is estimated to cost about $560,000 for those phases, and the second year is $441,000, and then the other costs go down in the later years of the permit, as most of the heavy, intensive consultant work of identifying and surveying all of our properties and all of our stormwater facilities and risk areas has been completed. And again, that contract was already approved by the board in June. Our baseline kind of industrial general permit cost that we've been having so far is about $93,000. That covers those permit fees and then consultant contracts that we have to come in and do the requisite sampling. It does not include some of these then potential extra things. So, you know, we have had a few testing areas where, you know, recently we've had some higher levels of contaminants that have been identified. So that's increased those testing numbers. We've then implemented these, the vault cleanup and the filter installations, and we're also doing further testing to really identify if the sediment is coming from our property or is it coming off-site and then flowing through MTS property onto other ones so we can identify other remediation. But those costs have been about $81,000 in addition to, and those are the ones that come up more unexpectedly. So then where we are right now, we just wanted to make sure you are aware that we have a stormwater compliance program and then that we are kind of keeping track of some of these challenges and additional cost drivers. One thing that we are discovering during the Parsons Brinkerhoff work is that a lot of the as-built maps for some of our facilities are not accurate. So they're not identifying certain storm drain facilities or they're in the wrong spot. And so we are working through this process to update those maps, you know, so that we have a better idea of what's out there. The sampling criteria for the various contaminants that the Water Board wants us to test for, it is actually, there's not that many labs that do this testing and that are available on the schedule. So we're working on trying to identify backup labs. Certainly anyone that's in this field that, you know, sees a growth opportunity, it seems to me that stormwater testing facilities, you know, have a big future in California. In general, we aren't the party to any of these, but we have seen a trend that third-party lawsuits are on the rise. So another reason to be diligent in compliance and make sure so that we can avoid being dragged into some of those costly and time-consuming lawsuits. We are working on documenting all of our compliance and ultimately believe that we will want a software program that will help us do that in a streamlined fashion that for people out in the field doing things. And so we're looking into our options there. And then finally, there are just various Water Board enforcement cases that come up. And what our practice has been there is that we engage our counsel and experts early on to monitor those cases and protect MTS's rights. So there's no recommendations. This is just no action today, just reports to let you know that this program is there, let you know of the budget impacts, which as we go into budget development, we'll be factoring these costs in, which haven't necessarily, you know, been at this level in previous budget years. So if there's any questions.
Any questions, comments? As you can see, it's going to be expensive, as it often is. And we have a lot of right-of-way, as you all know, a lot of areas where water drains. And so we don't really know what the final cost is going to be, but we have an idea of what we know about. And so just want to make sure you're aware of the budget impacts of that. Any questions, anybody? Thanks, Karen. We'll go on now to our security update report from our Chief of Security, Manny Guadarrama. Manny? Yes, as a chief of police, that's more accurate.
Good morning, Chairman Mathis and members of the board. I'm here to provide you a security update today. The crime statistics that I'll be presenting are for the first half of the calendar year. We're just about completed for the entire year, and we plan on presenting that in an annual report within the next couple of months. So one thing I like to always do is just remind everybody on the board what makes up our Transit Enforcement Department. We currently have 34 co-compliance inspectors. They have enforcement authority on our properties and primarily spend most of their time on the trolley. They do spend some time on bus, and they do security checks on all of our properties. They enforce MTS ordinances and certain state laws that have been approved by the board. The majority of our staff is contract security officers. For the first half of 2016 calendar year, we had approximately 175 security officers. They have the same authority as a private person. While they're in uniform, if they witness a crime, they can make a citizen's arrest, and then they need to call one of our co-compliance inspectors or the police. And then we currently have our joint agency task force. This is a multi-agency task force led by the San Diego Police Department, which is staffed with one sergeant and two police officers, two sheriff deputies, and then we rotate that sixth position with the other agencies that we serve. This was initially a grant-funded team. I'll talk about this a little bit more as I go into the presentation. They work 4 days a week, and they've had a significant impact on our system. Our new contract started in with our security contractor, which is Universal Protection Services. Became effective in July 1st, 2016. We went from 175 officers to an approved staffing of 194 officers. Since July 1st, the contractor has had significant challenges in meeting those staffing requirements. So what they frequently do, they will pay overtime to staff open positions that is not charged to us. There has been some positions on certain days that have not been staffed. They've worked on this pretty hard. They've improved quite a bit, but we're still not where we want to be. Part of the new contract, all security officers are wearing body cameras, as our co-compliance inspectors have been utilizing for the last 2 years. They've added some supervision in there. They added two lieutenant positions, which is the mid-level managers, and they've increased the number of training hours from 160 to 200 before they can even start as a regular employee for the contractor. Well, they're a regular employee, but before they can actually operate on their own here at MTS. We'll talk about the Part 1 reported crimes. As you can see, we started using ARGIS as our source for data. All law enforcement agencies in San Diego County report their data to ARGIS, and so for us, it's the most accurate. What makes it a little bit challenging for us and less challenging for law enforcement agencies is that if a crime occurs in a city, it belongs to the city. If it occurs here at 12th and Imperial, it may be MTS related, and it may not be MTS related because it may be across the street at the ballpark parking lot. So we take a look at each of those cases, so it's a little bit more time consuming than just pushing the button and giving you a total of what the crime stats are. In 2016, we saw, even though the number is still small, a significant increase in the number of Part 1 crimes that have been occurring on our system. The majority of those are property-related crimes. If you just look at the ARGIS data and you look at 2016, some of the drivers are larceny and theft and motor vehicle theft. That was a big chunk of it. We did have a slight increase in aggravated assaults and a very slight increase in robberies. We believe what's driving that is the Prop 47 and the AB 109 legislation, where AB 109 is the legislation to allow early release of nonviolent prisoners from prison and jails. And then Prop 47 was the decriminalization of many felony crimes that police officers used to put people in jail, you know, for example, like possession of heroin, which is now a misdemeanor, and oftentimes they're cited and released. Or if they're booked in jail, they're only in there for a few hours. So we have a lot more people that would normally not be out on the street that are out and usually in close proximity to our properties. There's an asterisk next to the rapes. because there's a three rapes, and, that, and the reason why we looked at those very closely because sexual assaults can be extremely alarming for the community. But what we found out, all three of those were in three separate law enforcement jurisdictions. Two of them were determined by the investigative agencies to be unfounded, completely did not occur. It was listed on our property. We were able to support those investigations with our video to demonstrate that they did not occur. And then the third one was mistakenly listed on the address on one of our properties. I also think that was unfounded, but it was never MTS related in the first place. The next part of the slide, the MTS response to data, those are the ones where our security staff or our co-compliance inspectors have actually been involved in. And you'll notice that the numbers are lower than the ARGIS numbers. And the reason is, and a perfect example is motor vehicle theft. If a car gets stolen out of one of our parking lots, the first call that a victim of auto theft will make is to a law enforcement agency. They don't call us. And they report it to that law enforcement agency, and they, in most cases, will not call us unless they think they want to, they're attempting to get video and see if they can get some evidence for us. So we document all the ones that we are involved with as far as reporting, and then we support law enforcement, but we don't always get informed. And same with just about any of these crime categories. Sometimes we'll learn about an assault that occurs because someone may have been assaulted, went home, called the police, or went to a hospital, and oftentimes we don't get notified. So that's why we rely on the ARGIS data as our accurate or accurate statistics. So on this slide, we compared our Part 1 crimes with the Los Angeles Metro. They have about three times the amount of ridership that we do. They have 1.03 crimes per 100,000, and we have 0.97. Both of those numbers are extremely low. When you consider in San Diego County, there's about 27 Part 1 crimes per 1,000 residents. So it's still a fairly low number, but it's a number that's increased for us. One thing that's different that you'll notice when you compare us with LA, the biggest increase for us, or the biggest number, is our property crimes, whereas they have a much higher violent crime rate. The Part 2 crimes are the lower level crimes, public drunkenness, drug violations, misdemeanor type assaults, vandalism, sex offenses is listed here, but these are not the attempt rape type sexual offenses, are more in the nature of an indecent exposure or if somebody was improperly touched, they're considered a sexual battery. That's what this captures here. In 2016, we made 191 Part 2 arrests. That's where we were involved, compared to 325 in the previous year. Part of the reason that number is low is because our task force is out there, and they are making a lot of the arrests that we were involved in the past. And the consequences for them is if they arrest somebody, that person goes to jail, whereas if we conduct an arrest, it's a citation, a misdemeanor citation, and they have to go to court. And they could be sentenced to jail, but that's not their first step. We did have an increase in 2016 of Part 2 crime reports, and the majority of the reason that number's gone up is that we're doing a much more thorough job of documenting the vandalisms that occur on our property. Everything else is pretty consistent, with the exception of the sex offenses. We did have about a 2-month period where we just had an inordinate number of indecent exposures, primarily the trolley, but also the bus, and we're not sure what drove that, if there was just happened to be big release of them in our area or what, but that since has gone back down to a more normal level. Now, on the bus side, we're able to track the calls for service because they come to our, they're made by our bus drivers, and it goes to our bus dispatch, whereas a crime that occurs on MTS property, if they call the police, it goes directly to a police dispatch. So we're aware of the calls that occur. These are calls for service, not necessarily crimes. Oftentimes when a bus driver calls and asks for security, by the time security gets there, their issue has already been resolved. Usually it's some type of disturbance. In fact, the number one type of call was the disturbance calls, followed by assaults and then vandalisms. And probably the safest place you'll ever be as far as being a victim of Part 1 crime is to be on a bus. In 2016, there were 17 Part 1 crimes that were associated with bus, and only four of those were on board. So the others were either at a bus stop or one of our transit stations. And we were involved in three arrests on the bus in the first half of 2016. Part 2 crimes, also very low, very consistent from 2016 to 2015. Again, the slight increase was from the vandalisms that we are documenting in a more thorough way. The number of Part 2 crimes on board the bus has dropped from 53 to 36 in the first half of the year, and the number of arrests have dropped to 26. And we are spending, as our co-compliance inspector, and we have a trained team, we call it a co-compliance inspector and a transit security officer. I've been riding the bus during each shift. We can't get to all the buses, but we are starting to take the busier routes and having higher visibility and inspecting for SDM violations. In our entire system for the first 6 months, there was 143 assaults. Those are both Part 1 and Part 2, so that can be as simple as someone spitting on a bus driver to someone getting hit with an object. Of those 143 assaults, 62 of those were on MTS employees, and primarily that is our security officers and co-compliance inspectors, and probably followed by bus drivers. Okay, as far as let's talk a little bit about our task force as far as enforcement. During the first 6 months, our task force became operational as a result of a grant in February 2015. We received a grant in 2014. We established an MOU with the agencies involved, and that MOU, we pay the salaries of the officers that are working on our system. We've gotten a couple more grants since then, but a much smaller amount, and we're about to run out of money in
2 or 3 months?
3 months.
So what we did is we worked closely with the San Diego Police Department so far and the Sheriff's Office, and they like the program so much because it not only improves safety on MTS property, but it also improves public safety on the communities that we serve. They've agreed to continue to staff that at no cost to MTS when the money's gone. So we still need to work on the smaller agencies. It's more difficult for them to give up personnel because they just have a smaller staff, but we have a proposal that we think that will get everybody involved in this. But in the first 6 months, they've made over 540 physical arrests. The majority of those arrests are not for new crimes that occur on our property, but the majority of them are people who are involved in criminal behavior, but they were arrested for warrants. And probably two-thirds of those were for warrants. We're starting to see a greater number of arrests made for people who failed to pay their trolley fares, and those turn into warrants. Some of the other impacts besides just the arrest statistics is that they've recovered 24 weapons. They've made 78 narcotic impounds. The majority of those narcotic impounds are very small amounts. Before I continue, I want to add that these contacts are by this task force are initiated during fare inspections, and it's generally people who do not have a proper fare, either to ride or to be on the paid fare zone. They recover burglary tools. They've contacted 139 documented gang members. They contacted 17 people that had Department of Homeland Security hits, which basically Department of Homeland Security or the Joint Terrorism Task Force will enter something in the system, and they ask to be contacted if these people are contacted. And we contacted 54 registered sex offenders. This is just a list of some of the drugs that they've recovered and some of the weapons. a lot of the weapons, you'll notice a lot of replica handguns. And you can just imagine why people might have a replica handgun on our system or anywhere. One of our focuses is to make sure people pay their fare, besides the security aspect. And we increased in the first 6 months of this year our fare inspections by 24.5%. And there was a 16.6% increase in the number of citations issued. And part of that is attributed to, on our co-compliance inspectors, we're used to be expected to make a certain amount of fare inspections. And what happened was that they get so caught up on getting their fare inspections that they would come across somebody who did not have fare and was deserving of some type of enforcement, but they let that person go because they're focused on getting the number of inspections. So we've changed that enforcement, there that posture and focusing on enforcement, and we're utilizing our contract security officers to do more of the fare inspections. And we believe in the long run, this is going to have a significant impact on our already low fare evasion rate. As you can see, we had a 1.3% increase in the number of citations for fare evasion. The number's not quite as big, but the biggest increase percentage-wise was the number of smoking violations, followed by failure to comply. We do special enforcement details to get an accurate reading of what our fare evasion rate is. And if you'll see that we listed controlled and non-controlled. And a controlled special enforcement detail is when we go to a station, we have a lot of employees, and we when the train stops, we board and we check everybody on board to see if they have proper fare. That's a controlled special enforcement detail. A non-controlled one would be where we have more time restrictions as far as holding up the train. We'll go on board, do a fare inspections, and then when people have an opportunity, I wouldn't say opportunity, but when they come across somebody that's in violation, they'll take that person off and they may not get an opportunity to check everybody on that train. So the controlled is a much more accurate measure of our fare evasion rate, and that's what we normally do. However, we changed our reporting process during the first few months of this year, and we didn't have distinguish between controlled and uncontrolled. So this is a combined amount, and so it's at 3.28. If we just relied on controlled details, the fare evasion rate more than likely would be lower. But this is probably one of the lowest fare evasion rates in the country, especially for an open system. Since July of 2015, we began focusing more on SDM inspections. On the trolley, we inspected 4,275,000 riders and inspected 488,850 of those riders had SDM cards. Some were using them improperly, and there was 422 citations with a violation rate of 0.13. Now, again, the violation rate is probably a little bit higher than that because when we have security officers working without a co-compliance inspector close by, they may not have the opportunity to actually enforce the violation. On the bus, on the other hand, is a controlled environment. The co-compliance inspector and transit system security officer are on board, so they can control everyone getting checked and actually do the enforcement on the spot. We did 38,000 of those inspections, 15,266 of those inspections, people had SDM cards, well over a third. The 97 citations were issued with a 0.8 violation rate, which is much lower than when we first started with our pilot in mid-2015. We've also do a number of quality of life or transient encampment details. Most often those are done early in the morning, and we did 15 during this first 6 months of this year, and you can see some of the violations that we enforced during that period. That's all I have for you today.
Yeah, so any questions?
Yes.
No, just I was able to be this last year on the Public Safety Committee and had this full report, asked a lot of questions, as you know, at that time, and had a tour of the security, and you've done a terrific job, I think, you know, from where I was a couple of years ago, and you're taking over, and I just want to say I think you've done a great job, and, you know, thank you for this report, and as a mom of a teenager who rides the bus, it makes me feel a lot better. So thank you.
All right, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Public safety is my number one priority, and it always will be. And just a question, code compliance inspectors are not uniformed, or are they?
They're uniformed, but they're unarmed.
Okay, they're unarmed.
Yes.
All right, and we have contract security officers. Do they go through a, you know, do we screen, I mean, how do we pick the contract security officers? How are they chosen?
Okay, the contract security guards, about 50% of them are armed and about 50% are unarmed. They're hired by the contractor. They have to go through training within their own organization, and then if they come to work for part of the MTS contract, then they go and get another additional 160 hours of training. Much of that is with a field training officer in the field.
Okay, is it almost like our police department training? Is it close?
No, it's not closer to our co-compliance inspector
okay.
training.
Gotcha.
After they've been employed for 1 year, they have to go through the 832 PC
okay.
course, which is the laws of arrest.
Okay.
Yeah, which co-compliance inspectors, we get them in as soon as possible.
Okay, that's what I wanted, because it didn't say that they went through the 832 PC training. Also, do you have a breakdown of the crimes per district, possibly, or could we talk about that at a later date? Because I just want to know what is happening in my district, especially because we have the second most used, you know, transportation,
right?
Transit.
We do have that. I think we have it broken down already.
Yes, Senate. We can do it within San Diego or wherever our trolley lines run. The bus might be a little more problematic because a lot of the crimes that occur at a bus stop are not MTS related. It's just by happenstance. But we can pull those statistics and put them together.
Yeah, the trolley would be great.
We use the same database that the San Diego Police Department uses. So it's ARGIS, and you can actually, there is a public website. It's hard to narrow down, though, specifically what is trolley or MTS related versus which is close by. But the public can also go on the ARGIS website and put in a very small radius and see what's occurring in specific locations.
Okay, and lastly, I know that we've been having issues with bias or diversity training with our officers. Do they go through that also in your 837 PC or whatever training they get?
Not specifically diversity training. We have some training that some of our training goals for this year is de-escalation training and how to interact with the public and recognize people in distress and with differences, and that I wouldn't call it specifically diversity training, but that component is part of the training.
Okay, I appreciate that. Thank you for the report.
Thank you.
Yeah, Mike Thompson here, who's going to give us the operations budget status report for November. Mike?
Good morning. Reporting on the operating budget fiscal results through the first 5 months of the year through November 30th. Looking at operating revenues, starting with fare revenues. Fare revenues continue to trend very unfavorable to budget. This is something that started at the end of FY16 and is carried over in FY17. Not only are we unfavorable to budget, we are also unfavorable to prior year as well, the $2.2 million unfavorable variance year over year. So we're just seeing generally soft ridership across the system that is translating into lower revenues. That is being partially offset by other operating revenues. There was ahead of plan by $500,000 or 8.8%. But in total, operating revenue is unfavorable to budget for the first 5 months by $2.5 million or 5%. That is being offset by operating expenses, so that's the good news. Operating expenses are favorable in total by over $2.8 million, also 2.5%. Large variances there are in personnel costs, with favorable variances both in wages and in fringes, and that's primarily in the bus and the admin side. We're also favorable by $800,000 on other outside services, which is general service contracts and repairs and maintenance and things of that nature. Some of that could be timing of those expenses. They're not really ratable across the year, and sometimes they're project-based. But we are favorable so far this year. We're also trending favorable in energy and other expenses. Again, in total, $2.8 million favorable variance that offsets the operating revenue variance. So for the first 5 months of the year, we are favorable to budget. Hopefully this continues. This does not look at subsidy revenues. We don't report subsidy revenues until the end of the fiscal year, but we do track certain subsidy revenues that are very volatile over the course of the year on our ongoing concerns dashboard. Primarily here is sales tax related revenues. This affects our Transnet revenues and also our Transportation Development Act revenues. That, as of this point, is trending unfavorable to budget. If you recall, I spoke about this the last couple of months, our budget was built on certain assumptions starting with FY16 and then carrying over to FY17. We missed FY16's number. It makes this year's number very impossible to hit. So we will expect that to come down. It will affect revenue in the end. Thankfully, our Transportation Development Act, there's a reserve at the county level that will backfill some of that. So there won't be a huge dollar effect in FY17 on sales tax related revenues, but there is a compounding effect that will affect FY18 when we get to that budget development cycle. The state of California budget affects our state transit assistant revenues. We had budgeted $14.5 million. There's been some revisions at the state level about the pool of money going into that program, and we expect to get a lot less this year. $13.1 million was the projection they produced in November. That will impact our operating and capital budgets. Passenger levels already talked about. We're significantly behind plan and also behind the prior year. The largest variable expenses we have are energy related. This has been favorable so far on the diesel and gas side. It has been trending up lately, but over the course of the whole year, we are favorable to compared to plan. And then electricity and natural gas, those commodity prices have come up recently, but we do expect to be on plan for those as well. So on the expense side, again, that is holding the line and letting us offset some of this revenue misses that we're having. That concludes my presentation. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? All right. Yes, Ms. Sapp.
Get it. There we go. I got it. I got to pound it. Just a clarification on that one right there on the budget. Passenger levels 95.3, year to date actual 38. Was the budget 95 for year to date or for the full year?
Full year, yeah.
Okay.
The only actual is year to date. That's the only year to date column.
Guy and I were having a heart attack over here. Okay. All right. Thank you.
Anything else? Seeing none. Thank you, Mike. Under item 60, I have no report. 61, there's no report from CEO. Paul's on travel. And are there any board member communications? Seeing none, I don't have any additional public comments. So with that, our business is finished and we are adjourned. Thank you very much.